Thank you for standing by, and welcome to the MLP Roundtable Webinar Conference Call. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. I must advise you that this conference is being recorded today, Wednesday, the 10th of October, 2014. I would like to hand over the conference to your speaker today, Nicolas Bornozis. Please go ahead, sir.
Thank you very much to everybody, and I'm sorry we got a bit of a late start, but good things take some time to happen. So thank you to everybody for being with us. This is Nicolas Bornozis of CapitaLink, and welcome to our webinar series. Today's webinar, it's an MLP roundtable discussion, and it features Clarksons, Goldman Sachs Asset Management, Swank Capital, and Tortoise Capital Advisors. We're delighted to have with us Matthew Phillips, the equity research analyst from Clarkson Capital Markets, who will be the moderator of today's MLP roundtable discussion. The featured panelists include Matthew Cooper, Vice President and Portfolio Manager from Goldman Sachs Asset Management, Brian Kessens, Director, Portfolio Manager, and Senior Investment Analyst from Tortoise Capital, and Daniel Spears, Partner from Swank Capital. I would like to thank you all for being with us and for sharing your insight on the MLP industry. This webinar has been accepted by IMCA for one continuing education credit. So if you have not provided your CIMA number upon registration, please email your number to us at funds@capitallink.com, and we will come back to you so you can receive the credit from CIMA. The event today is accessible through a live audio webcast, and then it will be also available as an audio archive accessible through www.capitallinkwebinars.com. I would like to point out that this is a discussion, so we don't have any slides for this conference call today. After the discussion, there will be a Q&A session, and webinar participants can submit their questions during the discussion, and they can use the special button on the event page. You can see that it's called Ask a Question, and you can click on that button and submit your question, or you can send your question via email at questions@capitallinkwebinars.com. As I mentioned, you can submit a question at any point of time during our discussion, and your questions will be addressed at the end. And before turning the floor over to our panelists, I'd like to mention that the discussion and opinions expressed by the webinar presenters are not intended as legal or investment advice or advice of any kind, as a matter of fact, and are provided for informational and educational purposes only, and CapitaLink bears no responsibility for them. Furthermore, the panel discussion may contain forward-looking statements concerning future events. In closing, I'd like to mention that our next MLP webinar will be on Tuesday, October 14, 2014, at 11 a.m. Eastern Time, featuring Cohen and Steers on MLP and infrastructure strategies, opportunities in a dynamic landscape. And of course, last but not least, we have our second annual MLP conference on March 5th, 2015 in New York, and we hope to see you all. And now I will turn the floor over to Matt and to our panelists, and thank you all for being with us. Matt, please go ahead.
Thank you, Nicolas. My name is Matt Phillips. I'm the an equity analyst at Clarksons, covering midstream and MLP stocks based in Houston, and happy to have everyone on the call today. So I'd like to kick things off by posing a question to all the panelists, starting with Matt Cooper. You know, you look at the IPO calendar for MLPs, and it's quite robust. We've had four to five MLPs filed just in the last week alone. I'm curious what the panelists think is driving such strong demand, both from the asset side as well as from the demand side for MLP new issues.
I think on the supply side, I think it's the continued build out we're seeing in the infrastructure space. The most recent being these ones that just launched recently. Cone, for example, I mean, huge build outs required in places like the Marcellus. We think that's going to continue. And we see these companies, these parent companies have, you know, huge infrastructure current portfolios as well as future opportunities to invest. So a guy like a Hess, which is on the block, the Cohn deal that just came out, and then the EQT in the past. I mean, these sorts of upstream names that have huge opportunities. And I think the other side is that they appreciate the valuation uplift they get in the MLP market. So on the other side of that coin, on the downstream side, you've seen the refiners do something similar. But, you know, at its core, all of this is being driven by this demand for infrastructure spending that we're experiencing, we expect to continue to see for the next several years. You know, on the demand side, obviously, I think there is some pursuit of yield that you're seeing. I think, you know, having been out recently and talking to several people in the market and investors and you know, getting their feelings on it, and there's some concern about things like, you know, the rally that we've seen in low grade bond market, and some concern there about what could happen there with interest rates moving in the future. And you know, they want some exposure to the yield that is offered by the MLPs and these new IPOs, but they also like the idea that there's some opportunity for distribution growth over time, which you don't get in the bond market. And you know, they think that that's a great way to kind of hedge that some of that interest rate risk you might experience with interest rates moving over time. And then I think also on the fundamental side, there is, like on the supply side, there on the demand side, there's this appreciation for the huge amount of investment and the opportunity set that is with these assets over time. And I, you know, it's not a next 2 or 3 year story. It's a next 10, 20, 30 year story. And, you know, just billions and perhaps even trillions of dollars will need to be invested to facilitate this production growth. And, you know, it's good returns, it's safe contracts or relatively safe, good contracts on it. And it's, ensures those cash flows. So it's a, you know, it's something that makes sense, I think, to a lot of investors.
This is Brian Kessens from Tortoise. I would concur with everything that was just said, and specifically just what it means for infrastructure growth, which right now is really unprecedented as it relates specifically to midstream projects from anything that we've ever seen before. And just as it relates to that longer term visibility to growth, there were two agencies, relatively independent, ANGA and the API, that recently commissioned studies that were completed by third parties with the goal really of assessing the level and the time frame of anticipated midstream projects just as a result of the North American energy production growth that we're seeing. And the quick highlights from those studies were that somewhere between $29 and $74 billion needs to be spent per year on midstream through either 2025 or 2035. Depending on the study that you're looking at. The broad differences in the numbers is just one of them included gathering pipelines and the other one didn't. And, you know, that takeaway is that really no matter what study you utilize, there just is a significant amount of capital to be spent, and it is going to occur over a long period of time. More near term into kind of what we've seen this year, if you just look at how infrastructure project announcements have ramped up throughout the year. In the first quarter, we saw that there was kind of a $7 billion of additional announced projects over the next 3 years, 2014, 15, and 16. In the second quarter, that increased to $17 billion. And then just in this most recent quarter that just ended, we expect that number to be similar to that $17 billion. So this project backlog just continues to kind of build upon itself. And I think that more than anything else is driving the strong demand for the IPOs.
Yeah, this is Dan Spears, from Capital, and I think I'd reiterate the comments from the other colleagues on the panel. And, you know, I think the basic and most simplistic way to look at things is that, you know, we're producing more crude oil and natural gas today than we were yesterday. We're going to be producing more crude oil and natural gas tomorrow than we are today. The infrastructure, the energy infrastructure in the United States is completely overwhelmed. Because of this, it's a good thing. And so we need to spend about $1 trillion over the next 10 years to simply fix our energy infrastructure. And, you know, the MLPs are there making these investments. You can see the bottlenecks in the Marcellus, trying to get the ethane, trying to get, propane, exports. And so there's just a lot of things going on. I think it's a great opportunity. And it's a very unique opportunity because, you know, we're heading towards, you know, North American energy independence by 2018 or 2020, and the beneficiaries are really the U.S. economy. Thank you.
Thanks, guys. All of you mentioned yield component as part of the attraction of MLP investments. You know, we've been in a period of low interest rates for some time now, and it's hard to determine how much longer this can continue, but I think many investors are positioning themselves for a potential higher interest rate environment. How do you see that affecting the group as a whole? What are the different scenarios in which that can play out?
This is Brian Katzens from Tortoise. I'll take a shot at it at least first. And you know, I think there's a few points, and we certainly evaluate the impact of rising rates from both a direct and an indirect standpoint as it relates to MLPs. From just a direct standpoint, there is an impact to the extent that a company does have floating rate leverage. But I think the key mitigating factor there is that as we look at the midstream MLP sector, about 80% of the debt is fixed rate, so that impact is pretty minimal. From an indirect standpoint, we look to assess the impact on the weighted average cost of capital and the returns over that cost of capital over time. And in short, while I think you could see some increases in the cost of debt and equity, there's some mitigating factors in our view that help lessen the impact of higher rates and ultimately allow companies to continue to grow their distributions. And some of those mitigating factors are excess distribution coverage. Right now, we just talked about all the internal growth projects that's in front of us, and that's internal growth versus external growth. And then you also have the ability to pass through inflation in a lot of cases via either higher rates or volumes. And then lastly, we just like to look at what actually has history shown us. And what we have seen historically is that when rates have increased by 50 basis points or more, the return of MLPs has actually been quite positive and similar to what you'd see with the S&P 500. In fact, MLPs have averaged a 6.1% return based on 17 different time periods that we've looked at when interest rates, as measured by the 10-year Treasury, have increased 50 basis points or more since 1990. So history shows us that that there's not necessarily going to be any big sell-off in MLPs.
Yeah, this is Matthew Cooper at GSAM. I would echo a lot of what Brian said. I would say, you know, intuitively you always think of MLPs as a yield and a growth type of an investment. So you would say, well, if you require some sort of interest rate spread above the risk-free rate, so let's just use the 10-year in this case, you know, if the 10-year climbs, then you would certainly expect, you know, the MLP, you know, yields to expand and hence the prices to drop. But quite frankly, the evidence has not really shown that over time. I mean, I think, you know, in the short term, if you get a spike of something like what we saw last May and June, it's very difficult to project what could happen there. And I think as we saw, you know, the MLP market dropped, I believe, 7 or 8% really quickly, but then recovered over the following 3 or 4 months. You know, it's a little bit tough because if you look, I think at the just, and again, these are 10 years I'm using here, but historically, or since the MLP market has been, you know, existing for all intents and purposes, we've been somewhat of a downward movement in the 10-year, I mean, over the last 30 years in rates. But there has been some, you know, times where you've seen rates moving up, and you know, I think a perfect example is between June of 2003 and June of 2007, you had the 10-year move up about 180 basis points. So, you know, somewhere around 45 or 50 bips annually, and it was a pretty gradual upward movement. And if you look at the total return of the AMZ during that period, it was still around 20%. So, you know, what else is going on there? Obviously, you're getting distribution acceleration, or distribution growth acceleration. And, you know, it's obviously weren't the factors, I think, that were are affecting the market now with huge backlogs of growth projects, but there were obviously growth projects, but they were more driven by the acceleration of the U.S. economy as opposed to what we're experiencing now, which is the backlog is driven more by just massive amounts of infrastructure to catch up with the production growth.
Yeah, I think this is Dan Spears. I think that, you know, what I would look at is you know, rising interest rates, if they're done in a measured way, like back in the Clinton years when they raised interest rates 25 basis points every time the Fed met, MLPs did quite well. And I think we've got to take a step back and realize that if we're raising interest rates, it means the economy is doing better. And if the economy is doing better, then the MLPs are able to, on the margin, make incremental income because people are utilizing more energy. And I think that's the most important thing to realize, that short intermediate shocks in the short term rates do cause MLPs to trade along with REITs, preferreds, and other interest rate sensitive equities. But the fact is, the growth story underlying the MLPs and the energy infrastructure needs is greater than what happens. So rising interest rates actually, I think, on the longer term is a positive.
Great. Thank you. One last question for the pose of the whole group. The profile of MLPs has risen significantly in the past 5 or so years. You know, with it, there have been calls to potentially change the tax status of the group. Do you see this as a significant risk going forward, or is the amount of investment and capital too great for things to really change in the near term?
This is Dan Spears. I'll take this to start off with. And, you know, in my humble opinion, I think the ability for us to have any meaningful tax reform in the next 2 years is zero. And while MLPs are out there, there's a lot of other lower-hanging fruit, like intangible drilling costs, home mortgage interest deduction. You know, so I think that, you know, for 2 years, I've got high confidence that nothing's going to happen in D.C. meaningful on tax reform.
Yeah, this is Matt Cooper. I would just add, the only legislation I'm aware of that's even been floated recently about MLP tax, if you want to call it reform, is the MLP income or the MLP Parity Act, which is introduced by Senator Coons from Delaware, who's actually seeking to expand, I believe, the tax treatment to renewable generation, so solar, wind power. So rather than, you know, doing away with the tax treatment, it's actually seeking to expand it to new sources. So, yeah, again, as Dan said, not too concerned about the tax treatment changing.
And this is Brian from Tortoise, and I'd echo everything that's been said. We certainly don't think it's a major risk, particularly over the short to medium term. There was also a proposal to revamp the tax code earlier this year from Representative Dave Camp from Michigan, and in that document of note was the fact that Camp elected to keep MLP tax status intact for those MLPs that are operating within oil and gas. I would point out that this is simply a proposal and not a bill, but, you know, per discussions with some of our Washington analysis groups, you know, it has very little chance of making it out committee, yet I think what's important is that it could serve as a potential laundry list from which to choose from for future tax reform, which would bode well for MLPs. And then, you know, clearly the MLP Parity Act, which has bipartisan support from Senators Coons and Moran, which expands the definition of qualifying income, I think is also a very good thing. So not only do we see much risk to the tax advantage status of MLPs, you know, going away, but if anything, we may see an actual expansion in the definition of qualifying income.
Interesting. Thanks for your comments. So, pose a question to Matt Cooper, GSAM. So, U.S. crude production has been rising at 15% or so a year for the past 4 years or so. Significant increase across the board. How long can this go on, and what is infrastructure's role in either limiting or speeding along progress of upstream production, and what will that mean for MLPs and basis differentials going forward?
Yeah, you know, at 15%, you know, I think that number obviously is tougher as your production base grows. Obviously, as the base grows, 15% becomes a bigger and bigger number. But do we think that there's the potential for, you know, the last year we've seen about 1 million barrels a day, or about 1.1, I believe, as of t- today's earlier announcement by the EIA. That number, it might be a little bit tougher to maintain as we move out, into some of the more, some of the more peripheral parts of each play. But I certainly think that you can target 600,000-800,000 barrels a day of production growth for the next several years. I mean, we think, in the next decade, it's potential to see in upwards of 12 million barrels a day of just crude production in the U.S. Where the infrastructure is going to be coming in there, I mean, I think it's going to, you're going to need to build it as quickly as possible to facilitate that growth. I don't worry too much about production growth being slowed by lack of infrastructure. I think we've, if you look at what's happened in the Bakken, where you've gone from, a decade ago basically having no production there to in excess of a million barrels today, I don't think you'd say infrastructure has hampered the production growth very much. What we've seen is the market has responded, and you've done things like huge amounts of rail build out there that has allowed that production to continue. Now, it does take longer, obviously, to get things like pipelines built, which should alleviate some of the differential concerns. So I think that is a reasonable concern, is that we will continue to see differentials, or at least volatility in them. I'm not sure if they will, how much more they'll expand, but I do think you'll see a lot of volatility. I mean, you've seen it recently in the Permian with, WTI Midland going out to $12, $13 below WTI because you just simply cannot get, the crudes out of the basin. And I guess I would say that could hamper a little bit of growth as, upstream guys, every dollar that they have to sell their crude at cheaper, that's one less dollar that they can put back into the ground. But I guess, on a whole, I don't think they will be hampered too much by a lack of infrastructure. I think if you look at the space now, there are just, whether they're private equity guys or the current publicly traded guys or some of the guys who are, as we talked about earlier, who have not gone public yet, but are, portfolios within larger E&P names or integrated names, I think they will be out there spending, huge amounts to meet these opportunities. And I don't think, if anything, it will be the infrastructure side of it holding up any production growth.
Yeah, this is Brian. I'd echo a lot of those comments also. We certainly think crude oil's growth is going to last, over the next decade. I think a part of that is just because people, they continue to kind of underestimate the impact that improved technologies had, even most recently, with just the increased intensity that we've seen with some of the horizontal fracking. There's just more sand that's being dumped down wells, and you're now looking at entire unit trains of, or like 100 rail cars loaded with sand that are going to go down one well. You're also seeing longer lateral lengths; those are extending to 10,000 feet now, and you're adding more frack stages, and all of this is just increasing the estimated ultimate recoveries of oil and natural gas in some cases, and in a lot of cases, it's also increasing your initial production rates. So, all of that's just leading to not only near term production growth, but well into the next decade. And if you look at Permian, Eagle Ford, Bakken, we expect growth in each of them between now and 2022 to be higher by 50%, at least 50% from where we're at right now. And we also wouldn't be surprised to see increases in the Gulf of Mexico, production increases in the Gulf of Mexico. There's a little bit of a case to be made. You may even see a little bit of an accelerated drilling just to the extent that the ban on crude oil exports is lifted. So certainly we're confident in the production growth. And as it relates to takeaway capacity, I'd agree in general. I don't think it's going to be that much of a holdup. But we still probably are 2 to 3 years away from having kind of sufficient takeaway capacity in those three larger crude oil basins, the Permian, Bakken and the Eagle Ford, from being able to transport all of the additional growth that we see between now and the end of the decade, whether that's by pipelines, new pipelines, or by the continued use of rail also.
Yeah, this is Dan. I would agree with all the comments on the crude side. I think the biggest issue that we're dealing with right now is on the liquids takeaway, whether that's propane, ethane, et cetera. You know, the Bakken is flaring 30% of the gas production right now. There's new regulations coming into play in 2015, and it's almost, you know, it's physically almost impossible to get enough of the gathering lines and stuff built. So I think the bigger issue in the short term is figuring out the issues on the liquids takeaway versus the crude oil, because I think the liquids is the bigger issue.
Thanks, guys. How does the growing production growth fit into your view with upstream MLPs? You know, their assets are a little less traditional than your pipeline guys and a little further out on the risk curve. How does that square with the rest of your portfolio?
Well, I'll take this one, given that we've got two funds dedicated to pure upstream MLPs. And, you know, pure upstream MLPs are not for everyone, but there's probably people that have a reason to want to own them in their portfolio because, you know, the correlation of the upstream MLPs is much closer to crude oil. And, you know, they're currently trading at about 500 basis points wide of the midstream MLPs. And while these guys hedge out 2 to 3 years, it doesn't matter. In a negative tape, we've seen this the past 30 days, with crude down, the upstream MLPs are down. And, you know, the problem is you've got to bifurcate the difference is, you know, the traditional model for the upstream MLPs is not to be in the fancy place. You know, look at the transaction that Lynn did. They're selling their high-profile stuff to get the stuff that's in a low decline rate of 2 to 3%. And so it's, I think it's a completely different model, and it's not about the near-term production. It's about low decline rate traditional production.
Yeah, this is Brian from Tortoise, and certainly we're, you know, the sector's mindful of, you know, the upstream company cash flows. They are impacted, frankly, by crude oil and natural gas prices, where midstream MLPs, you know, are not necessarily directly impacted in the way that upstream MLPs are. And at least in our mind, it's difficult to pay a sustainable and growing distribution, which is what the MLP structure rewards, with that volatile type of cash flow stream. Now, the upstream MLPs do try to mitigate that, you know, in a couple ways. One, upstream MLPs that reduce that volatility by hedging some of their production over a period of kind of up to 3 to even 5 years in some cases. And then I absolutely, you know, agree with Dan that they look to acquire assets that C-Corps are not necessarily looking to acquire, those assets with low decline rates or long reserve lives that are tend to be kind of non-core to other companies. Yet, you know, those hedges do roll at some point in the future, and the acquisition market is not always perfect from a timing or an opportunity standpoint. So, you know, we generally think that upstream companies are just better structured as C Corps, and that it's just very challenging for them to pay a consistent to growing distribution. And MLP's steady wins and midstream companies just tend to fit the model better.
Yeah, this is Matthew Cooper. I do think it's a viable you know, entity or structure for an MLP. You know, I think though it's as both other speakers touched on, though, I think it becomes tough with the idea of growing the distribution continuously over time. I think when you think about how much capital needs to be retained and put back into the ground just to maintain production, it's tough to determine exactly. There is some ambiguity amongst the upstream MLPs about how they think about their maintenance capital. You know, but I don't know of anyone that thinks of it on a true reserve replacement basis, i.e., it's here's our F&D cost, and this is what we're going to reserve. So, you know, it is a bit tricky, but I do think, you know, they do trade at a rather large discount to the midstream space, and I think there's good reason for that. And I do think some of them are viable investments. I do think, though, that investors need to be careful. I think you need to put a heavy focus on some of the leverage levels in some of these names and understand that risk as well as the hedge books, because there is a pretty high variance out there now between both the length and coverage on hedge books as well as debt levels. You know, and just think about how that both those scenario or both those considerations can affect an investment.
Great, thank you. So we had a large transaction announced in the space this morning. You know, the Kinder Morgan transaction from last month obviously made some waves in the space. What's your view on the acquisition outlook for the large cap MLPs, and you know, what does the Kinder Morgan transaction say about the rest of the large cap space? So what are y'all's views on that?
This is Dan, and I think, you know, from my perspective, the Kinder Morgan trade is just Rich Kinder taking advantage of financial arbitrage. He's done it before in the past when he took AMI private in 07, and so I don't think that that's a transaction that people should look at that is transformational. You know, looking at the oil tanking trade this morning, it's, you know, there's consolidation. There's a lack of space on the Gulf Coast for storage terminals, and so people are making long-term investment decisions based upon the need of where they see the markets going in the next 10 years, not in the next 2 to 3 years. So I think these are strategic transactions based upon a management team's and a company's view of where they want to have their assets positioned for where they view the market's going to be in the future.
This is Brian. I would agree with all that. That as it relates specifically to the Kinder transaction, there is a little bit of arbitrage there, clearly. And you know, they had to do something, and that they were in a little bit of a different they were in a different framework from just a cost of capital standpoint relative to even to some of their peers, and that KMP was relatively deep into the splits, and for them to just try to grow organically was going to be prohibitive from them to growing at more of a compelling rate. Just broadly, as it relates to the acquisition outlook, we think that, you know, companies that don't have that sort of internal growth and backlogs of projects are going to look to make more third-party type acquisitions over the longer term. You know, there's probably not a need for, you know, well over 100 MLPs, and that, you know, a number. Potentially half of that is probably sufficient from just a company size standpoint. So we would expect over the long term some consolidation to happen. And just as Dan indicated, because in energy, size seems to matter. In the midstream sector, the longer that you can control the molecule from as it comes out of the ground to when it reaches the end user, the more synergies you have with all of your asset base. So companies are going to continue just to look to for these add-on, bolt-on type assets or corporations, similar to what Enterprise did this morning with oil tanking, and we would expect that trend to continue.
Yeah, and this is Matt Cooper again. I agree with all of what's been said. I mean, you know, the Kinder thing I think was a unique situation, but at the same time, I mean, he has made no bones about it. Post the transaction, he is going to be looking to consolidate and buy names with this new currency, or rather it's an existing currency but a lower cost of capital at KMI. So, you know, I think if you look at what happened with the market Monday or the week after that announcement, certainly there were names out there that we thought were getting bid up because, you know, now people expect that this he's going to be out there, and they were kind of rumored as rumored as targets in the past. But, you know, yeah, as Brian just said, I think there's a lot of situations out there where if you're large and the more you can control the molecule and control that value chain, you know, adding up a new asset into your asset base that lets you control a little longer. So, you know, the sum of the parts is greater than they are individually. So, you know, 2 plus 2 doesn't necessarily equal 4. It's maybe equals 5 or 6. We expect a lot of consolidation to continue and more of the larger fish gobbling up the smaller fish out there to build out their portfolios.
Interesting. Thanks, guys. So we have a question from someone sent in. The market receptivity to the offshore and the shipping MLPs, you know, both of these businesses are historically quite cyclical and can be rather volatile. How does that square with MLP universe, where, you know, steady upward progress is what investors have come to expect?
Yeah, this is Matt Cooper again. Look, I think there are certain sectors out there in the offshore space that where they have long contract lives, a la LNG or some of the rigs out there. I mean, you know, yes, they are in somewhat volatile, you know, industries. You know, ship rates float every day, but if you can lock in 5, 10, even 15-year contracts for some of these assets at steady day rates with very high-quality counterparties, you know, okay, it makes sense in an MLP structure to us. I do think, though, just because you say a contract is 10 years with a investment-grade counterparty, it is still important to think about, you know, there's no – the contract – recontract risk doesn't not exist. It's just deferred longer. So – you know, there is some sort of terminal, you know, risk there you need to think about, and you need to value it appropriately. Maybe it's not going to come up for several years, but it's still there. The other piece of this that I think investors need to just be aware of is, you know, making sure that they understand the replacement reserves and how those are being thought of by the company, because, you know, boats have, for the most part, have finite useful lives. It's, you know, 20, 25 years. So you need to, I think, consider how much capital is being reserved by the companies, whether that's through the debt amortization or, you know, just replacement reserve on top of that, and make sure that there's going to be enough capital at some point in the future to replace a boat that has worn out its useful life.
This is Brian. I'd agree with Matt's comments. To the extent you're able to turn something that historically has been subject to kind of spot day rates, or spot rates or day rates, into something that's fee-based in nature, long-term, and then where you can also identify growth either from new builds or drop-downs, I think that, you know, that potentially has merit in the MLP structure, because the, you know, the distributions can be sustainable and growing. I do think that you just have to be mindful of the counterparty risk, and then also, to Matt's point, mindful of how the company is actually calculating their maintenance capex, and understand what happens at the end of the useful lives of the ships or the vessels, and what that potentially means for your distribution.
Yeah, this is Dan. I think my view on the shippers is there is a position for them in a variety of different portfolios, but I think more importantly, as the sector expands into areas like shipping, as we expand into areas of variable rate distributions, it just leads for the need for active management. And I think that's the focus is, you know, the days of buying an MLP and understanding that it's just going to be a long-term pipeline are over. There's a lot of new MLBs coming out that have a lot of different risk characteristics, and so I think it just continues to show the need for active management.
Thanks for the info, guys. Since tankers came up in this discussion, what's y'all's view on U.S. crude exports? I mean, is this something that can move the needle with regard to the overseas oil market? You know, obviously we've had a handful of condensate cargoes move out of the Gulf. You know, do you think this program will be expanded, either condensate or crude oil, over the next few years?
This is Dan. I'll take this one. So, you know, my view is 2008, we were importing 1.5 million barrels of, you know, refined products, diesel, gasoline, jet fuel. You know, today we're exporting 2.5 million barrels of refined products. And so my view on oil exports is, why would we want to do that? At this point in time, we have the raw commodity, and we're taking that raw commodity and employing people to extract it from the ground. We're employing people to transport it and to build the infrastructure to transport it down to the Gulf Coast to refine it. And so we take the raw commodity, we refine it, and then we export the upgraded end product at a profit, and it grows the economy. So from my point of view, no, I don't care if we export crude. Why should we do that?
This is Brian from Tortoise. This, as it relates to kind of our view on what's happening, is, you know, a lot of the crude that we are producing now in the U.S. tends to be of more of the light sweet variety, particularly the crude from, you know, the Eagle Ford is a very high API gravity, and and the same really from the Permian and the Bakken. And in our U.S., the U.S. refining system was really built. It's one of the more complex systems in the world, complex in that it was built to process more of a heavy sour crude, that crude that comes more from Mexico, Venezuela, and what we see growing with the Canadian oil sands in Canada. And our view is that at some point in time, you're going to reach kind of the capacity on what the U.S. refining system is able to refine into gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel from a light sweet perspective. And you're probably going to need to export that light sweet to alleviate kind of the potential discount that you would have on the domestic price, which is measured by WTI versus Brent. And if you look at some of the recent actions from the Obama administration, they have allowed crude oil exports, or at least in the form of condensate. There were two waivers, one given to Pioneer, the other one to Enterprise. And even yesterday, I believe it was the president's press secretary that was talking about the potential for crude oil exports. And he said that the administration is looking at it, and he was kind of starting to gently kind of make the case for it. We don't necessarily think anything happens before the election, but we certainly would not be surprised if sometime in 2015, 2016, that we do look at this this ban on crude oil exports, which really stemmed from the early 1970s when there was a crude oil embargo. We would expect them to take a look at that, and certainly wouldn't be surprised if they do lift the ban sometime over the medium term.
Yeah, I would probably fall a little bit more on Brian's line of thinking. I think, as he mentioned, you know, given that our refining base in the Gulf Coast is built out to, you know, basically run the imported barrels that we were getting from places like Venezuela and Mexico, I do think you'll continue to see a growing inventory as we've seen, or you know, of barrels there kind of collecting on the Gulf Coast, and. You know, I think it's tough from a political standpoint to sell something like allowing exports of crude when crude is traded in excess of $90. But I do think if those prices continue to weaken as our production continues to grow, I think, you know, the calls will get, you know, there will be more and more support behind them to relax some of the export ban. I think you'll see things like, maybe not full-on just selling crude without, you know, any sort of regulation to Asia or what have you, but I do think you could see more things like, you know, light for heavy crude swaps with places like Venezuela and Mexico. Obviously we're already sending a lot of crude to Canada, things of that nature. One thing I'm not sure if it would ever happen, but I think would be interesting would be a relaxation of the Jones Act, which says you cannot, which says you have to put any sort of intra-U.S., trade on U.S. flagged vessels with U.S. crews in a ship built in the U.S., which basically makes it very expensive to move crude from the Gulf Coast to the East Coast. I'm not saying this would happen, but I think if you were to relax that, it would be interesting because it would allow crude to flow from Gulf Coast where its inventories are building now, and much cheaper and easier get it to the East Coast refineries, which would then allow them to perhaps push out some of the imported, you know, West African or Brent-priced barrels that they are still being forced to purchase. Again, doubt that would happen, but I do think it would be very interesting if it did.
Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, Clarkson's has a historical focus on shipping, and so it's the Jones Act is something we've followed for some time, and it's proven quite difficult to make any changes to supporting the employment base of U.S. mariners and shipyards and whatnot. There seems to be zero appetite in Congress for actually making any change to that. I do agree that it would make the U.S. domestic oil market more dynamic, though, certainly. Let's move on to LNG quickly. There are, 20-something projects on the drawing board, and you have one under construction right now. How many of these get built? I mean, what are the panelists' views on how much LNG the U.S. Does end up exporting, and how does this affect domestic gas prices? Henry Hub has been traded in a range for several years now, and will LNG exports coming on stream bring renewed volatility to domestic U.S. gas?
This is Brian. I'll take a shot at least first. What we expect, we would continue to expect the FERC and the DOE to continue to approve export projects and to allow them to go to non-FTA countries. And at the end of the day, just the economics of the game are going to determine what amount actually gets constructed. And we expect, based on our analysis, about 8 to 10 BCF per day to actually get constructed and to be economic. That's based on kind of the current LNG market is just a little over 30 BCF per day. I think there is visibility to that doubling kind of between now and 2025. You can see that, but there's also a lot of other LNG projects that are coming on around the world, not just in the U.S., which also have very low cost natural gas prices, that being in Australia, off the east coast of Africa, and to some extent in Latin America yet. So we expect, 8 to 10 BCF per day to get built, and those are primarily going to come from the LNG projects that were more or less kind of first in the queue, like Sabine Pass, Cove Point, Cameron, and Lake Charles.
Yeah, this is Matt Cooper. I kind of echo a little bit what Brian said. We think, I believe there's been approved fully non-FTA right now around 9 BCF a day. The only one that's imminent in terms of commercial operations is Sabine, which, expected, I believe, Q4 of next year, perhaps Q1 of 16, first flows. But, I mean, if you look at the price differentials out there of Asian prices, Japan paid upwards of, I think, $16 per MMBTU right now, and Henry Hub at sub $4. Yes, even though you're paying a liquefaction fee of $3 and it's costing you $1.50 or $2 to take it over to Asia, and even with an empty transload back, I mean, it still makes sense. It still makes a lot of sense, and I think it's why you saw a lot of the large Japanese utilities and the South Koreans is just jump on the opportunity to get capacity. I think in terms of the U.S. market, how much will of a dent will it make in the pricing going forward? Difficult to say. I mean, we tend to believe that given what we think is the production growth profile for natural gas, we are going to need every outlet possible, whether it's more retirement of coal-fired power being with natural gas generation stepping in, additional pet chem demand and NGL, because if you look at the projections out there, you're talking 4 or 5% annual gas production growth, for a very long time. And while that doesn't sound like a huge number, if you just put that kegger out there for the next 15 or 20 years, you see that there's going to be a lot of gas floating around in the next 10, 15 years that's going to need to find a home. Otherwise, prices will just continue to stay extremely weak.
This is Dan. I think I take a different approach on this. I think we'll end up exporting 8 to 10 BCF a day. But given the industrial manufacturing renaissance that we're seeing because of the fact that we have abundant cheap source of energy again that we haven't seen since the 50s or 60s, that, there's no reason for us to want to get our prices to the level that is being paid in Europe or that's being paid in Asia, because we're bringing back hardcore industrial manufacturing jobs because we have cheap, abundant source of energy. So I think at some point in time, you will reach a point, because, there's 80 different projects going along building in the Gulf Coast, spending about $100 billion to expand the pet chem industry. And projects along those lines, the greatest emerging market right now is located between the Rockies and the Appalachian, and it's because we've got cheap, abundant source of energy. And so, from my view is, let's keep that cost advantage, because it's bringing back hardcore industrial manufacturing jobs, and it's creating, the huge drivers behind the economy and what's going to drive our GDP for the next 10 years.
Thanks, guys. We're nearing the end of the hour here. Nick, if you're on, I don't know if we have time for any more questions or you want to make any closing statements. Nicholas?
I'm right here. That was a great discussion, and thank you to all of you for your insight and for your very active participation. I don't know if anybody would like to make any closing remarks. I'd like to mention only that we will also have a transcript available of this webinar. So the webinar will be available as an audio file for anyone who would like to access it at www.capitallinkwebinars.com. And within a day or so, we will also have a transcript, so anyone is welcome to request a transcript at no cost. If anyone would have any closing arguments or statements, let us have them. And for my part, thank you to all of you.
Thank you. Thank you. Appreciate the time.
And we had a great turnout, by the way. So that was a very lively webinar. It shows the interest in the space. Thank you to all of you, and I guess we can all disconnect.
All right. Thanks very much, guys.
Thanks.
Thank you.